I've got a question about the word suicide. But not as it refers to its literal meaning. When I was a little kid, my brother and I would go to a convenience store or a fast food place where you could fill up your own soda. And when you put different types of soda into your glass, that was called a suicide. And I thought that was just something my brother and I said, but I guess it's not. Everybody I know says that. And I was just wondering how that word got attached to doing that.
Who made this world? Where my wife's man and her husband are not one and the same, where poets are extremely talented, but some of them vain, act like they'd be willing to bust one in your brain, especially when they start gunning for name. I swear, the more things change, the further I go insane. I'm shell-shocked. I ain't no good for no woman no more. Perhaps I should just barricade myself in here with my daughters. It don't seem correct to subject some innocent woman to my marriage-induced post-traumatic stress disorder. Sometimes I think this living room couch is going to become my from here on out living quarters. Then eventually, after continuously waking up here, my eyes are just going to well up with water. I mean, a lesser man would just do it. But I would rather be crucified than commit suicide. And any hustler, whether they be dead or alive, would recognize that the look in my eyes is strictly do or die. Besides, people that commit suicide must not believe in God. Otherwise, they would understand that there's a rhyme and reasons why this life gets so hard, and they would put their nose to the grindstone and get used to the taste of their own blood, because life is a monster of a mobster, and you got to get your chops up if you wish to associate with that known thug. This world is like the Wizard of Oz, and until you show some heart, you don't never get shown no love. So when you're feeling desperate, thinking you done gave all you got to give, and you ask yourself, who made this world? The answer is simple. You and your actions did. If you don't like the way that the life you live is changing, then isn't it just as obvious that you must live your life to change the way you live? Happiness is mathematic. That's all it is. Happiness is mathematic. That's all it is. Happiness is mathematic. That's all.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
My friends, before I begin the expression of those thoughts that I deem appropriate to this moment, would you permit me the privilege of uttering a little private prayer of my own? And I ask that you bow your heads. Almighty God, as we stand here at this moment, my future associates in the executive branch of government, join me in beseeching that thou wilt make full and complete our dedication to the service of the people in this throng and their fellow citizens everywhere. Give us, we pray, the power to discern clearly right from wrong, and allow all our words and actions to be governed thereby and by the laws of this land. Especially we pray that our concern shall be for all the people, regardless of station, race, or calling. May cooperation be permitted and be the mutual aim of those who, under the concepts of our Constitution, hold to differing political faiths, so that all may work for the good of our beloved country and thy glory. Amen. My fellow citizens, the world and we have passed the midway point of a century of continuing challenge. We sense with all our faculties that forces of good and evil are masked and armed and opposed.
What do you make of this extraordinary news cycle we're currently in, with incredible uprisings all over the Middle East, with the continuing global recession, with earthquakes and tsunamis and nuclear crises? It's been an extraordinary period. What have you made of it from your standpoint?
Well, you probably shouldn't ask me that, considering my TV show is called Conspiracy Theories.
Well, exactly.
Which, of course, we have a thing up in Alaska called HARP that can create all these disasters with the weather. I went and discovered that. It's located up in Alaska.
What would you mean?
You
can't just say that. You mean, you got a place in Alaska that can create?
Yeah, it's called HARP.
What do they create there?
Well, it's 50 antennas, basically, that put out 50,000 watts, which is the maximum you can for radio, and it combines and shoots it up into the ionosphere, and they ricochet it off back to the ground. They can knock planes out of the air with it. They can control cloud movements and all that with it, with the weather and all this stuff. And they call it an unclassified research center. But I know that that's a lie, because when I went up to go inside, they wouldn't let me in it. So clearly it is classified, so they're lying on the classification to begin with, which is, governments do that. They lie a great deal, it seems, today.
Well, that's also the theme of your book.
You know, that's a standard that's very important to us. If you got a 22-minute show and a guy takes 5 minutes to warm up, he's out. One of the reasons why Nightline has the usual suspects is one of the things you have to do when you book a show is know that the person can make the point within the framework of television. And if people don't like that, they should understand it is about as sensible to book somebody who will take 8 minutes to give an answer as it is to book somebody who doesn't speak English. But in the normal given flow, that's another culture-bound thing. We've got to have English-speaking people. We also need concision.
I mean, you mentioned Rwanda, and that was obviously scandalous that people didn't get involved sooner than they did. Millions died as a result.
Yeah.
When you see what was apparently about to happen in Benghazi in Libya, where it appeared that Gaddafi was about to slaughter possibly hundreds of thousands of his own people, is there not a humanitarian duty for countries like America to try and prevent that if they can?
Yeah. But I think that you have to go maybe on the perspective that it has to, the first shot has to be fired first.
But he was being fired. He was killing people.
Oh, he was? Well, yeah. Then sure. Then obviously there should be an intervention at some sort. But why is it always the United States?
Well, it's not. It's NATO as well. You've got an alliance of countries. Why are you laughing?
U.S. media are alone in that it is, you must meet the condition of concision. You got to say things between two commercials or in 600 words. And that's a very important fact, because the beauty of concision, you know, saying a couple of sentences between two commercials, the beauty of that is that you can only repeat conventional thoughts.
What would you do about oil then?
What do you mean? What would I do?
Well, for example, by your yardstick, if you don't go and get involved in places like Egypt, when there's an uprising as there was, and you get extremists in charge who decide they want to punish America, and they want to get together with the Syrians and the Yemeni and the Iranians, and they're going to stop any oil coming out of the Middle East to America, then what?
Well,
that would devastate your economy.
No,
here,
not necessarily.
And it would devastate
Americans. I live in Minnesota, and we don't get any oil from there. Ours comes from Canada. Okay. The point I'm making is there's oil all over the world. But the world is running out. But our dependence, don't you think we need to shed our dependence on it? All the money we're spending in these wars to get oil, if we turned around and spent that on solar energy and moving that forward, things of that nature forward, the amount of money we're spending to secure this oil, if we took half of it and just spent it on alternative energy, we could break this resistance, and then we wouldn't be compelled to have to go over there and ensure.
Do you
want to know why we're in Afghanistan?
I'm fascinated.
It came to me 6 months ago when a story came out that they found a vein of lithium there that they say is worth $1 trillion. Now, what is lithium used for? Every cell phone, every computer, and soon-to-be electric cars. Yeah, so why don't they just, Piers, tell me the truth?
No, but Jesse, that's not...
We're going there to get lithium so that we can live like we live. Don't sit and try to sell me.
Jesse,
to give democracy to the world.
Jesse, it sounds a bit like you've been on lithium. Come on, you can't seriously imagine we've gone to war in Afghanistan over lithium. Come on. Be serious.
I am serious.
My brother just served a 7-month tour of Afghanistan.
I am serious.
He did not risk his life for lithium.
What did he risk it for?
He risked it because everybody knows that Osama bin Laden was training people to commit atrocities in Afghanistan.
We all know that.
That's a fact.
You're talking to the wrong guy.
Well, you're a conspiracy theorist.
I don't believe 9/11.
But you don't believe in anything.
No, I believe...
You believe everything has an ulterior motive?
Not true. Not true at all.
I've read your book.
Not true at all.
Let me have a short break. When I come back, I'm going to throw at you a few stories. I want to see what you think happened. Let's test these conspiracy theories, all right?
I get up on Nightline, say, I'm given whatever it is, 2 minutes, and I say, Gaddafi is a terrorist, Khamenei is a murderer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The Russians, you know, invaded Afghanistan, all this sort of stuff. I don't need any evidence. Everybody just nods. On the other hand, suppose you say something that just isn't regurgitating conventional pieties. Suppose you say something that's the least bit unexpected or controversial. Suppose you say,
I mean, the biggest international terror operations that are known are the ones that are run out of Washington.
Or suppose you say, what happened in the 1980s is the U.S. government was driven underground.
Suppose I say the United States is invading South Vietnam, as it was.
The best political leaders are the ones who are lazy and corrupt.
If the Nuremberg laws were applied, then every post-war American president would have been hanged.
The Bible is probably the most genocidal book in our total canon.
Education is a system of imposed ignorance.
No more morality in world affairs fundamentally than there was in the time of Genghis Khan. They're just different, you know, they're just different factors to be concerned with. Now, Chopsy, thank you.
Well, you know, people will quite reasonably expect to know what you mean. Why did you say that? I never heard that before. If you said that, you better have a reason, you know, better have some evidence. In fact, you better have a lot of evidence, because that's a pretty startling comment. You can't give evidence if you're stuck with concision. You know, that's the genius of this structural constraint.
John F. Kennedy's assassination.
Yep.
Who did that?
It was done by William Harvey, who was the head of the CIA's assassination unit at that time. David Morales was directly involved in it. He likewise is the gentleman who killed Che Guevara down in Bolivia in 67, where they put him up against a firing wall and killed him and shot and killed him. Morales was part of that. I believe that because I saw, heard, and read a confession from E. Howard Hunt on a deathbed to his son. And when he confessed, it was not a confession of remorse. It was a confession of pride. He wanted the world to know
that
we helped you out. We killed John Kennedy, this communist sympathizer.
But Jesse, aren't you being slightly naive? People can say anything on a deathbed to immortalize themselves. When I die, I might say, you know what? I don't want anyone to know about my long-standing love affair with Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah. Doesn't mean anything, does it?
I can be slightly naive, except the fact that you're not going to convince me he could make those shots.
Why?
Because I tried them, and I'm an expert marksman. He wasn't.
The U.S. media are alone in that it is, you must meet the condition of concision. You got to say things between two commercials or in 600 words. And that's a very important fact, because the beauty of concision, you know, saying a couple of sentences between two commercials, the beauty of that is that you can only repeat conventional thoughts.
Your theory of 9/11 is what?
My theory of 9/11 is that we certainly, at best, we knew it was going to happen. They allowed it to happen to further their agenda in the Middle East and go to these wars.
So just to clarify, President George Bush knew that 9/11 was going to happen, that 3,000 people were going to get murdered.
They had all the information. If you looked at the NSA documents, if you look, well, put it to you this way. The August 6th memo was pretty clear.
Yeah, but do you genuinely believe, Jesse Ventura, that President George W. Bush knew 9/11 was going to happen?
No.
Why do you say it then?
No.
Well, why do you say it?
But I believe Dick Cheney knew it.
Really?
Yep.
You believe he knew it was going to happen?
I believe they had a good... Well, why did John Ashcroft quit flying commercial planes that summer and switch only to private planes? Why did that happen?
You don't honestly believe these people knew. I don't believe you believe that. You don't honestly think Dick Cheney knew it was going to happen. You can't do.
Do you really believe Piers? It's not irrational.
Excuse me.
Do you really believe that evil people can't be in charge of governments? If you do, go talk to the Germans. They know a little about that, that evil people can get in charge. The governments are run by people. People can be bad.
So Dick Cheney's involved, Ashcroft's involved, all these people got together and planned, come on, it's madness.
Oh, that's madness. But you'll fully accept that 19 Islamic radicals armed with box cutters taking orders from a guy in a cave in Afghanistan could defeat our multi-billion dollar air defense system, which the Russians couldn't do.
Jesse, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened.
Who are you to wave your finger? You must have been out your hair.
The U.S. media are alone in that it is, you must meet the condition of concision. You got to say things between two commercials or in 600 words. And that's a very important fact because the beauty of concision, you know, saying a couple of sentences between two commercials, the beauty of that is that you can only repeat conventional thoughts.
Would you agree if the CIA discovered tomorrow that they knew where Osama bin Laden was, that he should be assassinated?
No.
What about Gaddafi?
No.
You don't care?
No. I think they should be arrested and tried in a court of law. Since when does we, what are we, in the Wild West? We just go out and if people we don't like, we kill them?
Isn't that what you did?
Everyone's willing to be killed?
Jesse, with respect, isn't that exactly what Navy SEALs do all the time?
No, we're at war. War's different.
Well, we're at war with Osama bin Laden.
We are?
Aren't we?
Here's an our rude boys. The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word. Is books part of the media?
Absolutely.
What is the point of them? I mean, I ain't done this, but has any of you actually ever read a book?
Oh, of course.
No. I was talking about the old thing.
I've read thousands of books in my life. I have a
I don't show off.
But well, I mean, some people... Name one then. Name one?
Yeah.
I was reading one today called Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Is that a real book?
To my understanding, it was a film, but it may, may also
be a book. All right, so that's a film. That ain't a book. What does you think about violence on TV?
Nobody, I don't think, in their right mind would say there shouldn't be any violence in entertainment. The question is, do you depict it in a way that makes it appealing?
But what harm has violence ever done?
Oh, death. I mean,
yeah, but apart from that?
Well, death and injury. I mean, if you don't die, you're injured.
All right, well, apart from that, those two things, Does you think that violence on the telly leads to violence on the street?
Well, I begin with, I wouldn't limit it to television. You got film, you
got violence in the media,
you got video games.
With full respect, though, that is BS.
That's down for bullshit.
Because me watch Star Trek, but that don't mean that me go out and build a spaceship and fly into the air and above that into the thing called space and have, you know, all them ears. And all that thing.
To me, that's the point.
Answer that.
There's a difference between violence that is readily and is easily imitatable versus ray guns.
Should telly be used to educate our children?
The television could be a powerful medium for education.
Well, like Sesame Street is very educationalist. I have learned a lot from that. Why don't they make a version of Sesame Street for kids?
That's what it's for.
What?
been no change to the conditions that the Gaddafi regime must meet since they were set out by President Obama and by our Prime Minister and others. That means an end to all attacks and abuses against civilians. It means a real and genuine ceasefire, the withdrawal of regime forces from cities, and the full flow of humanitarian assistance to the people of Libya. There should be no ceasefire that does not meet the conditions of UN Security Council resolutions 1970 and 1973 in full, and that is not acceptable to those representing the opposition in Libya, including the Interim National Council. Anything short of this would be a betrayal of the people of Libya and would play into the hands of the regime, which has announced two utterly meaningless ceasefires since the fighting began, without its vicious military campaign skipping a single beat. And we will therefore continue to judge the Gaddafi regime by its actions rather than by its words.
I didn't expect that in 3 weeks, suddenly, as a consequence of an air campaign, that Gaddafi would necessarily be gone. What I said was that under the UN mandate, we had an obligation to protect civilians from potential atrocities, and we have succeeded in that. It's true that some civilians may be still getting killed, but we don't have wholesale slaughter in places like Benghazi, a city of 700,000 that Gaddafi said he would show no mercy on, because that's a site of a lot of opposition. So what we've been able to do is to set up a no-fly zone, set up an arms embargo, keep Gaddafi's regime on its heels, make it difficult for them to resupply, and you now have a stalemate on the ground militarily, but Gaddafi is still getting squeezed in all kinds of other ways. You know, he's running out of money. He is running out of supplies. The noose is tightening, and he is becoming more and more isolated. And my expectation is that if we continue to apply that pressure and continue to protect civilians, which NATO is doing very capably, then I think over the long term, Gaddafi will go, and we will be successful. But again, it's only been 3 weeks, and I'm actually very impressed with the performance of NATO so far.
David Cameron, Barack Obama, and Nicolas Sarkozy have dismissed calls for an immediate ceasefire in Libya. The coalition partners issued a statement saying that Gaddafi must go and go for good before rebuilding of the country could begin. This comes as the Libyan dictator's daughter Aisha held a defiant rally in her father's Tripoli compound. Surrounded by pro-Gaddafi supporters, she led them in chants and had this message for the coalition.
The idea of Colonel Gaddafi stepping down outrages all Libyans. Gaddafi is not only in Libya, but also in their hearts.
Colonel Gaddafi was seen driving through the streets of the capital on Thursday as NATO airstrikes shook the city.
God. They found me. I don't know how, but they found me.
Run for it, Marty!
Who? Who?
Who do you think? The Libyans!
My fellow Americans, this evening I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
My duty to the American people to report
that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply. The initial attack on the destroyer Maddox on August 2nd was repeated today by a number of hostile vessels attacking two U.S. destroyers with torpedoes. The destroyers and supporting aircraft acted at once on the orders I gave after the initial act of aggression. We believe at least two of the attacking boats were sunk. There were no U.S. losses. The performance of commanders and crews in this engagement is in the highest tradition of the United States Navy. But repeated acts of violence against the armed forces of the United States must be met not only with alert defense, but with positive reply. That reply is being given as I speak to you tonight. Air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam, which have been used in these hostile operations.
Now it's happened again. Less than 7 weeks ago, the President of the United States in the city of Washington. Today, the Pope in the eternal city of Rome. But now, at the end of this dreadful day, we can say this with certainty. The surgery on Pope John Paul was completed after 4 hours and 20 minutes. Hospital officials say the operation was successful. Vatican Radio says the Pope is not in serious condition. Now, for a full report, we go to our foreign desk in London and Peter Jennings. Peter?
Frank, it was just after 5 o'clock in Italy. John Paul was doing what we've come to call his special thing, riding through St. Peter's Square in Vatican City, reaching out to touch the children held aloft for his blessing. Suddenly, shots from the crowd. According to eyewitnesses, the Pope froze in shock for a second and then slumped to the seat of his jeep. Our correspondent in Rome is Bill Blakemore.
The Pope had already been driving slowly through the crowd for some 15 minutes in his open jeep, especially designed to get him as close to as many people as possible, when, passing the same point in the square for the second time, the shots were fired. John Paul slumped into the arms of his private secretary, was rushed back out of St. Peter's Square, past the stunned pilgrims and tourists who moments before had been crowding close for a touch, a word, or a smile. Eyewitnesses disagreed on the number of shots they'd heard.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly. This morning, I want to tell you what I did and why I did it. For nearly 2 years, the United States, the nations of Latin America and the Caribbean, have worked together to resolve the crisis in Panama. The goals of the United States have been to safeguard the lives of Americans, to defend democracy in Panama, to combat drug trafficking, and to protect the integrity of the Panama Canal Treaty. Many attempts have been made to resolve this crisis through diplomacy and negotiations. All were rejected by the dictator of Panama, General Manuel Noriega, an indicted drug trafficker. Last Friday, Noriega declared his military dictatorship to be in a state of war with the United States and publicly threatened the lives of Americans in Panama. The very next day, forces under his command shot and killed an unarmed American serviceman, wounded another, arrested and brutally beat a third American serviceman, and then brutally interrogated his wife, threatening her with sexual abuse. That was enough.
On behalf of our nation, I salute my predecessor, President Bush, for his half century of service to America. Our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan because of the imminent threat they presented to our national security. I want to speak with you about the objective of this action and why it was necessary. Our target was terror. Our mission was clear: to strike at the network of radical groups affiliated with and funded by Osama bin Laden, perhaps the preeminent organizer and financier of international terrorism in the world today. The groups associated with him come from diverse places but share a hatred for democracy, a fanatical glorification of violence, and a horrible distortion of their religion to justify the murder of innocents. They have made the United States their adversary precisely because of what we stand for and what we stand against. A few months ago, and again this week, bin Laden publicly vowed to wage a terrorist war against America, saying, and I quote, "We do not differentiate between those dressed in military uniforms and civilians. They're all targets. Their mission is murder, and their history is bloody." The most recent terrorist events are fresh in our memory. 2 weeks ago, 12 Americans and nearly 300 Kenyans and Tanzanians lost their lives, and another 5,000 were wounded when our embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were bombed. There is convincing information from our intelligence community that the bin Laden terrorist network was responsible for these bombings. Based on this information, we have high confidence that these bombings were planned, financed, and carried out by the organization bin Laden leads. America has battled terrorism for many years. Where possible, we've used law enforcement and diplomatic tools to wage the fight. The long arm of American law has reached out around the world and brought to trial those guilty of attacks in New York, in Virginia, and in the Pacific. We have quietly disrupted terrorist groups and foiled their plots. We have isolated countries that practice terrorism. We've worked to build an international coalition against terror. But there have been and will be times when law enforcement and diplomatic tools are simply not enough. My fellow Americans, our battle against terrorism did not begin with the bombing of our embassies in Africa, nor will it end with today's strike. It will require strength, courage, and endurance. We will not yield to this threat. We will meet it, no matter how long it may take. This will be a long, ongoing struggle between freedom and fanaticism, between the rule of law and terrorism. We must be prepared to do all that we can for as long as we must.
Make no mistake, I don't do anything for free. I keep my enemies closer than my mirror ever gets to me. And if you think that there is shelter in this attitude, where do you feel the warmth of my gratitude?
Was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people. Correspondent Jacqueline Adams has the story.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. They discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Imad Salem. Unbeknownst to the FBI at the time, Salem recorded many of his conversations with his handlers.
I'm holding 903 pages of draft transcripts.
William Kunstler represents Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman and several others charged with conspiring to blow up a series of New York City landmarks 4 months after the World Trade Center bombing. That case has not yet gone to trial. Kunstler confirmed newspaper reports of the Salem transcripts. In one, Salem complains to an FBI agent, "Since the bomb went off, I feel terrible. I feel bad. I feel here is people who don't listen." The agent replies, "Hey, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't try and I didn't try. You can't force people to do the right thing."
There is material in here to show gross governmental misconduct.
Today, attorneys for the defendants in the ongoing World Trade Center bombing case formally asked for the transcripts of Salem's tapes.
Quite frankly, it's beyond me why now, the fourth week into the trial, we still don't have these materials.
Prosecutors have refused to comment publicly, but legal experts say the defense may have no right to those transcripts.
Of course we're after Saddam Hussein, bin Laden.
I've got a tiger by the tail, it's plain to see. I won't pay my twin, you get through with me. Well, I'm a losing weight and I'm turning mighty plain.
First days as a nation, we have put our faith in free markets and free enterprise as the engine of America's wealth and prosperity. And more than citizens of any other country, we are rugged individualists, a self-reliant people with a healthy skepticism of too much government. But there's always been another thread running through our history. A belief that we're all connected, and that there are some things we can only do together as a nation. We believe, in the words of the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, that through government we should do together what we cannot do as well for ourselves. Now, part of this American belief that we're all connected also expresses itself in a conviction that each one of us deserves some basic measure of security and dignity. We recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, hard times or bad luck, a crippling illness or a layoff may strike any one of us. There, but for the grace of God, go I, we say to ourselves. And so we contribute to programs like Medicare.
Wondered whether you could print stuff in 3D, or found yourself wishing your cat could wash itself? Well, look no further. This year's gadget show in Birmingham has something for everyone. Whether you're a petrol head, a gaming junkie, a toy lover, or into the latest state-of-the-art household appliances, from the practical to the just plain weird, they've got it all. Jason Bradbury, who presents the show, explains why gadgets are so exciting.
You'll see here at the gadget show, people going, a lot of the time going, whoa! You know, when they see something that they've read about or something they've never even seen before. I mean, mind control, it's here. It sounds like bonkers comic book stuff, but it's actually here.
So don your 3D specs and open your mind to the unending and catwashing possibilities of the gadget world.
Thank you.
German engineers say they've unlocked the secret of how birds fly and mechanized it. The smart bird is a lightweight robot that can mimic beating wings. Designers unveiled the Winged Wonder at the 2011 Hanover Industry Trade Fair.
Verbraucht ganz wenig Energie.
Designers say the carbon fiber bird was inspired by the seagull. Its wings not only beat up and down, but also twist at specific angles. That movement is made possible by a torsional drive unit, which engineers combined with a control system they say attains an unprecedented level of efficiency.
Flying saucer, but a flying source of weather relief. For organizers of the 2022 World Cup in Qatar have really been feeling the heat to switch the tournament from the summer to the winter. But with the event still scheduled for the warmer months, engineers have come up with this. It's a remote-controlled artificial cloud. Yep, artificial cloud to shield an entire football stadium from the sun. That's pretty cool, right? They're the size of a jumbo jet, and they are made from lightweight carbon fibers.
Did you know that xylophone is spelled from X?
Yeah, sure.
But zoo is spelled like with something.
The other one. The zoo is spelled with Z.
Do you think that there should be censorship?
We have censorship on television.
Me grew up watching whatever me wanted. Me was watching pornos from the age of 11. I mean, don't see me Julie complaining now. Every time. So, does you think it's all right to see animals on the telly?
People having sex with animals?
What? No.
Oh, you mean sex with animals. Animals having
no,
sex.
No, animals.
Animals having sex with
no.
animals?
Yeah, take it easy. It is disgusting enough seeing a woman and a horse do it, but actually seeing two horses getting jiggy together, that was actually on the television.
While I don't personally enjoy watching two elephants have sex on a PBS special, I don't consider it pornographic.
So, does you think the media put too much attention on women to look a certain way?
I think that it does clearly present an unreal image of life.
But does you think there's enough pressure being put on women from the media? Because there's still so many fatty boom booms walking around.
People need to think about that.
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
A controversial American author has angered religious groups with his new book about Jesus Christ. James Frye's new novel, which imagines the final testament of the Bible, is a gritty take on the second coming of the Messiah, in which Christ is depicted as a bisexual drug addict.
Sometimes he'd take them in the bedroom, men and women, both, and he'd close the door, and I know he'd be doing things to them and loving them and making them feel better, same as he did to me. When I was writing the book, I thought to myself, if Messiah was here, what would that person be like? How would they live?
Due to be published over here on Good Friday, it's outraged Christians, who see it as deliberately controversial.
It's completely overramped. He's puffing it up as the third section of the Bible, as the Old Testament and New Testament of this book. It's nothing of the sort. It's an interesting novel if you like that sort of thing. I personally wouldn't buy it. And I'd recommend people, if they want to read it, go to the library so he doesn't get the satisfaction of getting money out of us and getting royalties.
Its success could have a lot to do with where you live. In America, it no longer has a mainstream publisher. It remains to be seen how well it will do over here when it's released in time for Easter.
Now, go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.